Blog Talk Radio.
Choices, decisions, frustrations, and pain. Knowing I'm going to forget her someday. While I still can, I'll challenge all my loved ones, every friend, to look inside their hearts and understand that I will love. While I still can.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to Alzheimer's Speaks Radio. I'm your host, Lori LeBay, and I'm the founder of Alzheimer's Speaks, which is a advocacy group based in Minnesota, providing multiple platforms to shift our dementia care culture from crisis to comfort worldwide. So we're just thrilled to death that you're with us today. If by chance you have to scoot, remember all of these episodes are archived, so you can go ahead and listen later if something comes up, and you can always go ahead and share them with your friends. We appreciate your likes and your tweets because, again, we're in this boat together about shifting our care culture and spreading the knowledge that's available and sharing worldwide. We believe by joining forces and, again, sharing that knowledge and having just these everyday conversations that we do on Alzheimer's Speaks Radio and our blog and through our dementia chats, that we can really improve things. We can remove the stigmas attached to memory loss, and we can help people in the trenches take back their lives with purpose. Together, we can help everybody understand the true needs of this disease. And at our core, collaboratively, we can win this battle. I know we can. And again, I want to thank our audience as well, because we were recognized as the number one influencer online for Alzheimer's by ShareCare and Dr. Oz, which was just a marvelous recognition. And again, that would not be possible without all of you being so actively supportive of what Alzheimer's Speaks is doing. So again, thank you so much for that. We're about raising awareness and, again, giving voice to those who are afflicted with memory loss, as well as their care partners and advocates and business professionals supporting dementia, and sharing best practices, what works and what doesn't work. Rick Phelps is our channel expert, and I don't know if he'll be able to tune in today and join us. Rick has early onset Alzheimer's disease, known as EOAD, and he pops in when his schedule allows him to do so. And so again, if Rick pops in, I'll definitely pull him into the show. He's the founder of Memory People, which is a support group, a closed support group on Facebook. So if you haven't checked that out, that's something that you may be interested in doing. I want to let you also know that if you are interested in joining the conversation here, it's really quite simple. You can use the chat box to make a pose a question or ask a comment, or you can call into our phone number, which is 714-364-4757. Again, that's 714-364-4757. And I want to also thank Alzheimer's Disease International just for their support. We're going to be having them on the show from their conference in Asia, which will be really interesting, on April 18th. So if you're looking for an Alzheimer's Association anywhere in the world, that's a great place to be able to go ahead and just zone in and find what you're looking for. Today's show, we're going to be talking about transgender needs with dementia. And so, you know, with this particular group, I mean, they're getting a double whammy. And so it's really important, I think, to have this discussion today. So I'm very excited to introduce, we've got three guests with us today. And the first I'm going to introduce is Kay Fox. And Kay was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease in 2008 at the age of 66. Early in her career, she worked as an aerospace engineer, and she contributed to the Gemini and Apollo space program. And before retiring, she worked as a pastor as well at a Christian rescue mission in Rochester, New York. In 2007 is when Kay really started to notice some of the changes in her ability. And we'll talk more about that within the program. She is currently a member of the National 2012 Early Stage Advisory Group, and she's extremely interested in advocating for support groups that concentrate on living with the disease and planning for the future. And more specifically, as a transsexual woman, Kay's special interest is in developing a safe meeting place for people who are transgender. So welcome to the show, Kay. I just realized I have to unmute you here. So how are you doing today, Kay?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for the introduction.
Well, wonderful. Well, great. I'm going to go ahead and introduce our other two guests versus doing it kind of throughout the show. I think we'll just go ahead and do our introductions up front. Our next guest that I want to introduce is Sam Wiley. And Sam is a case manager, and he is a certified information and referral specialist. He's worked over 12 years in aging and disabilities field, and he's worked extensively with individuals and families involving disabilities, mental health, and Alzheimer's disease, along with other related dementia. He has held jobs on the Council of Aging and the Department of Social Services, Adult Protection Services, and the Area Agency on Aging. Currently, Sam is the Vice President of Programs and with the Alzheimer's Association in South Carolina. So welcome, Sam. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Lori. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. From here, I'm going to go ahead and introduce Lisa. And Lisa Fox is Kay's partner. And they met when Kay was volunteering at the Open Door Mission. So they have known each other about 32 years. And when Lisa first met Kay, Kay was a man. And then she discovered she was transgender in 2000. They've been legally married for 10 years. And Lisa has been Kay's caregiver. And she's going to talk about how that's taken a toll on her health and how she's able to support Kay in this role and what she sees some of the needs being. So welcome, Lisa. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me on.
Well, great. I'm really excited to have this conversation because I just think it's so important. I also think it's very confusing, the terminology. So I'm going to start, at base one. And let's have Kay, if you don't mind, talk a little bit about what are the terms, what really is transgender? And Kay, can you define transgender for us?
Well, transgender is a umbrella word that covers a multitude of other words. We often read about and hear in newspapers, or not hear in the newspaper, read in the newspapers, and hear on radio and TV, the letters GLBT. And briefly, that's a common term that's used to describe someone who is under this umbrella. And the G stands for gay, and that may be a male or female, but it usually refers to a male. And the draw on that is the same sex, male to male. There are many people that are gay who are married in states where it's legal and are also have families and raising children. by adoption. And L stands for lesbian, and that, of course, refers to female and same-sex relationship, female to female. And they, too, in some states, are married and or living together in other states, and they, too, also have had children. Sometimes one or the other becomes pregnant by a surrogate and bears a child and brings it into the family. Then we have bisexual, the B part. And bisexual means that the person lives with either sex and presents as either sex, male or female. And they may or may not float back and forth frequently, depending on how they are feeling at that particular moment or time. And finally, the T in GLBT is transgendered, and that may be a male changing their genetic sex, not changing their genetic sex, but changing their presentation from female, or less frequently female, to male. And this can require extensive surgery and hormone therapy, counseling, and a whole host of other things. And as you were indicated earlier, I am a transsexual clergywoman, and legally, and there are other titles that go along under this umbrella of transgender. You can have she sex, he sex. You can have intersex. There's a whole host of things that I won't go in naming them all. But to become transsexual entails surgery, and which is either partially or completely reconstruction of the sexual organs and components, and it also requires extensive counseling of a number of years, and with a specialist who is an expert in gender counseling, and it's followed along by both a medical doctor and a psychiatrist. All of that takes place 2 to 3, maybe 4 years before any surgery is done. And as I indicated, I am a transsexual woman. Overall, these terms that we're discussing fall under what are called gender identity dysphoria, which is a fancy name the medical community has given to it, and it's a new name which is found in their medical Bible, so to speak, DMS-5, which just was released and published. Prior to that, transsexualism was considered to be a disease, and now they have removed that stigma of disease because of a number of different conflicts that have gone on, and have attached the term gender identity dysphoria. And the medical community has now agreed, both the psychiatric and psychology and the AMA, as that transgenderism is considered a pre-birth condition. It's part of a development in the womb and is not a disease.
Okay.
And the other thing, it's not curable.
Okay.
It's sort of, to illustrate it, it's sort of like being born with a cleft lip. And the baby is born with that cleft lip, and surgery can correct that cleft lip, and surgery can also alter the sexual organs of a transgendered person and bring them into congruency with the sex that was always there.
Okay. So it gets rid of the theory that this is just a choice that people are making. There's really a physical, attribute in terms of why these needs and feelings and so forth are there. So wonderful. I'm going to go ahead, Kate, and pull Sam into the conversation here because I want to find out, what the Alzheimer's Association, how they view this cohort group and what they're looking to do to make some changes within their organization to be able to supply support. So, Sam, can you discuss a little bit of, why it's important to address this community need?
Yeah, I can. We all come from different backgrounds, different religions, and because we all need very specific things in our life, Alzheimer's affects everyone differently. And so what we are recognizing is that, and understanding is that, we have to be able to identify the specific needs that individuals have in order for us to better serve those individuals. And clearly with the LGBT communities, there are specific needs. And for better for us to understand how we can bring the needs to the LGBT communities, we need to know more about what those needs are. And so we as an association are really trying to learn more nationally, even within our own chapters nationwide, to be able to currently identify needs, learn what they are, and so we can set up the right proper amount of support and care that these families need in order to help them as they go through not only the families but the individuals themselves, in order to help them as they're affected with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias.
Now, I know the Alzheimer's Association does like an annual diversity and inclusion report. Were there any statistics there that you wanted to share or kind of summary?
Actually, we do have a report. Unfortunately, my fault is I was not able to get that report from our national office at this point in time. That is something that I'm looking to try to with, but we will have that information as soon as we can, and I can be able to share that with you, Lori, as we go forward for any of your listeners that would like to have any more information on that in the future.
Okay. That would be absolutely wonderful to be able to have that. I'm going to go ahead and pull Kay back into the conversation here. And, Kay, can you give us a little kind of back history on yourself, what life was like for you and how did you transition, to be a transsexual? So can you kind of paint a picture for us of your life, just kind of a snapshot so that people have a little better understanding?
Sure, I'll be glad to. Not long after I was born, I was about 7 or 8 years, I knew that I wanted to be a pastor. And then several years later, I noticed that there was a difference in my activities and interaction with other people, with other kids my age, and I tended to gravitate to females rather than to males, and would love to play with dolls and things of that nature. And I had a girl living next door to me, and she and I played together quite a bit. That went on for a number of years, and all the way through high school, because I knew I was different, and I felt that there was a battle going on inside of me. It's like a tug of war between two combatants, and as I grew up and as I progressed and went into the work world, this battle kept on going inside of me, and even when I was working, as you mentioned, with spacesuits and things of this nature, as well as a number of other positions, and then finally got ordained and had my childhood dream of being a pastor, and I was, and I ran a mission for 35 years, which went from an $11,000 operation to, when I retired, $3.5 million operation, being funded only by the public and no foundations or United Way. And we had a multitude of programs. I was outed at work, what happened was during this battle that was going on, I had been seeing a gender counselor in Syracuse, or near Syracuse, who was working with me on identifying my feelings and, you know, and direction and things of this nature, and whether they were genuine or whether just exactly what was going on inside of me. And was doing this all during the time that I was working at the mission. And,
okay, I'm going to interrupt you a second now. During this time, were you previously married then?
I was, when you were, yes.
Okay, so you're married and you had children too, correct?
I was married and I had six children.
Okay.
excuse me. And one day I was in my office and there was a knock on the door, and in came my ex-wife and the board, president of the board of directors. And suddenly my whole life got turned upside down because I was outed as a transsexual, and was immediately placed on a sabbatical, which turned into a dismissal semi-retirement program. The whole thing going on through my life was that there was stigma, two stigmas attached. One was the stigma that, I was presenting genetically a male, which I wanted to get rid of desperately, and didn't do so because I was afraid of what people thought and what they would do. Working in the Christian work world, I knew it would not fly very well. And so I you know, I kept it under wraps, but I kept fighting it, and yet desperately felt like it had to come out. And stigma, if you're familiar with the word, it comes from Latin, which means point, and it uses that the origin of it was that they used to brand people that way. They would take a stick and they would brand them with a dot, sort of like the scarlet letter. This stigma, you know, stayed with me, and the fear of it coming out and people deserting me and my friends and so on and so forth, and my reputation, because I was very well known in the community and nationally and internationally. And so I kept trying to submerge this feeling, this urge of making a transition. And that battle kept on going. And so consequently, finally, after those many years, I started to go to counseling, to a gender counselor who was outside of Rochester, because I didn't want to deal with anyone in Rochester in fear of something that might leak out. And we worked through all the dynamics of the counseling regime for gender dysphoria, and the conclusion was that I actually was female in a male body. And
what was that like when you got that diagnosis finally? How did that feel?
I was relieved.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, I had a diagnosis from somebody who was an expert and who knew what they were talking about, and that it wasn't just a fantasy of mind or a wishful thinking type of thing. It wasn't a cross-dressing type of issue, but it was a real issue. And during the counseling, I became knowledgeable about how all of that took place and from birth on. And so I felt relieved about that.
Mm-hmm.
I was still male, and I still worked at the mission all during the time that I had that counseling, and until I was finally retired. And when I was retired, I came out full time.
Okay.
I'd written a couple of letters to some friends of mine. One happened to be a radio program director, and the next thing I know is he put it on the air on a 50,000 watt clear channel station, which reached 39 states, and the next net result was that everybody knew. And so for that day, I had television trucks and radio and so on and so forth at my house, doing interviews up until 11 o'clock at night, talking about transgenderism and being a transsexual. And
that
brings me to that, you know, point in my life where I was now fully out. I didn't have to explain to anybody because everybody knew. It was the talk of the town.
Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and pull Lisa into the conversation here, because I want to talk about seeing some changes within you in terms of memory loss and the dementia. So, Lisa, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay. Can you tell us when you started seeing some changes in Kay, and you know, give us maybe some examples?
It was probably in early 2007. She would forget where things were. She would forget what day of the week it was.
Was she still able to drive and maneuver independently?
She was able to drive. She was allowed to drive, so we went to the neurologist that we were seeing here in South Carolina said that she needed to have a guardian and conservator, and the judge of the probate court in Charleston County then revoked her driving privileges. She would get lost, make wrong turns, not know where she was. Can't imagine being a passenger with somebody who doesn't know where the heck they're going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and everybody with dementia is a little bit different in terms of their driving capabilities and things. I know the doctors will even say that, and that's why a lot of the counties and stuff are doing testing and retesting and things there. How about you, Kay? What kind of things were you noticing that caused you to go get diagnosed?
Well, when I was working towards the end of my career at the mission, I noticed that I was forgetting things. I was a kind of person where you wind me up, watch me talk, and it wasn't unusual, like on a Sunday, for me to speak in two churches and my own. I had Bible studies and things like that, but I was finding it difficult to research what I wanted to do and what I wanted to say and put it down on paper. And I would be forgetful. Towards the end, I would forget appointments in my busy schedule. They just drift right by, and I never knew it until I got a call. As I look back on that from where I am today, I think all of this really began probably 10 to 15 years prior to the time that I was diagnosed with dementia.
Okay, and that's pretty common. People will say that they'll see signs, you know, way ahead of time.
Right.
But you don't notice them because they're small and they're minute and they're not kind of connected and they're not really interfering with your daily life as a whole, or you don't think that they are. So when you went to the doctor to get the diagnosis of dementia, you know, how did that process go? Was it how were the doctors? Sometimes people really struggle with how they're treated by the physicians. Did you have a good relationship with your doctors?
I had a very good relationship. When I was living in Rochester, New York for 10 years, on weekends while I was working for the mission, I was also the hospital chaplain of an inner-city hospital. So I had many opportunities to act or interact with patients that had dementia. So I was not unfamiliar with what was going on. My relationship was with my doctors was very, very good because I could talk the language and still, and we'd be on the same page. So I knew what dementia was, and specifically what Alzheimer's was, and I knew the path that it took and followed. And those people that, I ministered to those people that had or with dementia. And so I was not foreign to that at all. My relationship with my psychiatrist, my psychologist, my primary care physician, and my neurologist was excellent. And when I got the diagnosis, I had just gone through several medical experiences. One was I had cancer and was operated on for that. And then I had a respiratory infection that hospitalized me for over a week or so. And, so all of those things combined things
pretty
to be
major.
Concerned about.
Yep.
Pardon?
Yep. All pretty major situations that you had to deal with. When you actually heard the words, is there anything that kind of went through your mind at the time when they said you have dementia?
Yeah, I guess the first thing that went through my mind was, well, that figures. I didn't get all depressed and weepy and so on and so forth about that diagnosis because I had been trained for many years as an engineer and as a clergy person and having worked with people that had Alzheimer's, it was just another bump in my road of life. And so it didn't... quite frankly, it didn't really
didn't throw you for a loop. It sounds
panic.
Like.
Yeah.
Okay. Lisa, how about?
I accepted it and moved on.
Okay, Lisa, how did it affect you when you heard the diagnosis?
It was pretty devastating. I didn't know a lot about it. I know a lot more about the disease and its progression. Being a caregiver is very stressful and has unfortunately adversely affected my health. I have ulcerative colitis. I had that as a child. I was in remission for almost 30 years, and 2 years ago it resurfaced, and now I'm on some pretty heavy-duty medications to try and bring things under control.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fatigued a lot of the time. It's been stressful in handling some of the financial aspects due to our specific situation. And also, getting Kay to take her meds, getting her to eat, getting her to drink enough. It wears me down.
So it's not uncommon.
Too.
Yeah, it's not uncommon for a caregiver to feel overwhelmed, and for it to start affecting their health. That's extremely, extremely common. Kay, I'd like to ask you first, and then I'll come back to Lisa on this, but Kay, can you address what do you feel are the specialized needs of the transgender population when it comes to memory loss?
Well, again, it's for them, for our community of GLBT, et cetera, people that have Alzheimer's and are also fighting a gender identity, it's a double stigma to that. And a considerable number of them stay in the closet, so to speak. They don't come out. They don't participate in anything. They play a role of, you know, whatever genetic birth that they have, even though they like I did, was the battle going on inside between the two. So the problem is coming out as a GLBT person is the stigma that's attached to that, and the loss of friends and things like that. And it's more pronounced in the transgender community because it's more noticeable. You don't necessarily notice gay or lesbian folks in the community unless they're very outwardly affectionate with each other. Whereas a transgendered person makes a total complete change and presentation. And so there are a lot of transgendered folks that just are staying in the closet simply because of the fact of the stigma that's attached to that. And it's same as it is with Alzheimer's. That is a close parallel to what goes on with a person as it does with a person that has Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very common for people to say how isolated they feel, and people pull away and don't understand. And so to get that, I can't even imagine the double isolation effect, because one layer of it is more than anyone should have to bear in their lifetime. And then to, have a second one put upon you, I can't even imagine from a mental health standpoint.
And in my case, when I came out, I lost my family.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have two children that will talk uh-huh. to me, but the rest won't have anything to do with me, and won't answer emails or acknowledge cards or anything. And one of the interesting things was that when I came out, the person that I was most afraid of telling was my mother. And she was in an assisted living facility. And so finally one day I decided I just had to tell her, and I did that. And when I told her about it, she turned around and responded back to me, "Well, that explains a lot of things." And that mm-hmm. floored me. She didn't get upset or anything else. She was later interviewed for a news report and things like that. And she stood by me through all of this that I was going through. And before I forget, any of our listeners that are interested in transgenderism, is there is a book put out called True Selves, which is by Brown, and I forgot the other author. But it's a classic book on transgenderism and the problems and things like that. And it's written for pretty much a cross-section of society so it can be understood.
Well, that's good. That's good. Let's. I'd like to pull Sam back into the conversation here and talk about, you know, support groups and, you know, how they're developed and you know, where are there some support groups, you know, that can help this particular population. And
Sure. Well, to let you, you know, just kind of tie back in with a previous question you asked me is that right now with our national office, the national office is really working very hard currently to develop the right programs, not throwing things together. I wanted to take that time to make sure that we get these programs for families and individuals in place. As we've heard from Kay and even with you, Lori, it is difficult for individuals what they're facing. And so, you know, specifically each chapter across the nation, we have over 8 chapters, actually has support groups. Some chapters are doing better work in the LGBT communities than other chapters. You know, specifically, I can speak on the South Carolina chapter. We are literally at the front door of trying to understand and develop these programs and services that individuals in the LGBT communities need. I know out in California and some other chapters in that area, they are really setting the standard for what the groups and support groups are for individuals that are needing those type of care and support. Here we're just getting started with the help of Kay and Lisa. We are really rolling up our sleeves and trying to understand what we need, as I said before. We currently do have support groups nationwide. Every chapter has them, as I said. We have support groups here in South Carolina, but we do not have any specific support groups tailored to this to the individuals in the communities here. And so that's where we are. I think as on a national stage, we are trying to get our hands wrapped around Alzheimer's, and then we're also trying to get our hands wrapped around the very specific needs individuals and families need across the nation, even with their own states. Every state is different. And so here in the Bible Belt, we are working to really try to do a better job of reducing the stigmatism. I think we're doing a good job of that, but we've got a lot of work to do. So we have support groups, but as far as where we are as a South Carolina, we're really starting to open a door, and with the help of Kay, actually, and Lisa to help us do that.
Okay. I would like to pose to our listeners, if anybody has any questions or comments, please use the chat box, or you can call into 714-364-4757. That's 714-364-4757, and then you'll have to push 1. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Again, the Alzheimer's Association is looking at what are the needs. So the more chatter we can give them, the better we can get these groups developed for people. You know, and are these groups, are they going to be a separate group where it is just transgendered people with dementia, or is it going to be a more diverse group? Kay, what is your thought on that? What would you like to see?
Well, basically, the plan that I'm working on at the present is a GLBT caregivers support group that meets once a month or whatever to be able to share experiences and to be able to encourage each other. The hardest part of all of this is trying to identify those individuals that might benefit from that kind of a program. Because, as I said earlier, a lot of them, folks are afraid to step out because of the stigma and don't come out of the closet. So I'm working with elder lawyers and folks like that that might know of clients and make them aware of our desire to start a group for fellowship and exchange of information and things like that, and have medical people make some presentations and stuff of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just wondering, you know, we brought over the Memory Cafe from the UK, and we've got that here in Minnesota, and that's a group where it's people with early memory loss and their care partner, and we just kind of sit around and have these normal, everyday discussions, and we have built such a strong community. And to me, I almost wonder if it makes sense going to, you know, these communities and just starting a group. And because a lot of people won't say that they have dementia, you know, if they're transgender or not. I mean, people just don't talk about it.
Right.
So I think it's one of those things you have to put out there, and you can't give up. You still have to show up for the meeting, and over time, kind of that word of mouth and that comfort. Because, like you said, now you're going to have people with a double stigma coming out. But if you started in a safe group, you know, a safe community amongst yourself, maybe that might be easier for some people. Others may just want to go to just a regular old support group and not feel intimidated or uncomfortable because they're transgender. And so I think that might be one route to look at it. But I know with our Memory Cafe, I mean, we could have easily given up after 3 months because it was like, gosh, there's only a couple of people here. But it takes time. It really does. Mm-hmm. It takes time and it takes effort. And during that time, we got to, even if it was just one or two couples, we got to get really build our relationships, you know, with them. And that, I mean, they're just the foundation of the group now, and they believe so strongly in it. And so, you know, like I said, it might not have to be real complicated. And sometimes I think we make things more complicated than they are. You know, throw it out there and try it, and if it works, you know, if it gets legs and walks, you know, you're doing something right. And if not, tweak it. But I think sometimes when we put groups or projects together, we think that they have to be perfect before we launch them. And I just think the need is just way too great. And to let the group have input on what the group should be. Because ahead of time, we're just guessing, you know, with that. And so, again, with our Memory Cafe, we had one from 1 to 3, and we had one from 6 to 7:30. And after a while, the group said, can we just have them both 1 to 3? And we went, sure. You know, this is your group. You know, it's about meeting your needs. It's not about meeting the facilitator's needs. And I think that's, you know, if we stay with that focus when you're developing a group, it makes a huge difference, and it allows you to be flexible, to be able to meet the needs. I'm going to ask Lisa what she would like to see in terms of a support group. Lisa, are you looking for some type of support group with dementia?
I had been involved with a support group here in the Somerville, South Carolina area, but that group sort of disbanded.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm really looking to get involved with memory people on Facebook. And I find that's an excellent, there's just a ton of resources there. People aren't forced to come out. You're not forced to go someplace. But there is a tremendous need for support, for respite care. Just so, say I want 4 hours to my, just me time.
Yep, and that's important for balance.
Right. And with my illness, it's just, I'm limited in some aspects as to, you know, what I can and can't do. But there is a severe lack of support for care partners in this area. Like your memory cafe, I'd prefer an afternoon group as to an evening, for the simple reason I have trouble driving at night.
Mm-hmm.
So something that's during the day would probably be more helpful, but there's the anonymity to a degree when you're communicating on Facebook,
mm-hmm.
and that takes some of the stigma away. I've never felt the need to explain in a support group that my spouse is transgendered. I usually refer to it, Kay, as my husband if I'm discussing it on Memory mm-hmm. People or in a support group. And it's tougher here, and I know Sam would agree, in the Bible Belt, it's just another stigma because,
mm-hmm.
first of all, Alzheimer's. Second of all, I don't fit under the LGBT umbrella. I'm heterosexual. So they just, I think a group where there's just generalized support would be appropriate. Like Kay said, a lot of the GLBT people are not going to come.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worse in the South than it is in other areas of the country.
Okay.
South Carolina, and Sam can attest, is a very conservative state.
Okay.
But as far as getting support from the doctors and neurologists and that, we've been truly blessed. Our primary and the neurologist they don't look at the gender issue. They see the person.
Mm-hmm.
And they've just been, I can't say enough good things about either one of them. I mean, when there's advocacy been needed to get a certain medication or get patient assistance paying for that medication, our doctors have been great.
Mm-hmm.
Up in Rochester, the primary doctor that Kay and I were both seeing separately dismissed me from his practice.
Okay.
Because I was involved with Kay, and he didn't agree with that.
Oh, that's
going to
be difficult. So
yeah,
as far as groups right now, you don't have a physical group, and you're using one in social media.
Right.
But are you interested in having a physical group to visit, if it can be the right mix?
If it could be the right mix, yeah.
Okay.
It's like, and this is off subject a little bit, but I'm going to have to go for a sleep study in the near future to see if I have sleep apnea. I have
mm-hmm.
to take Kay with me
mm-hmm.
because there's nobody here to stay with her.
Uh-huh.
And I'm expecting the medical people will be able to figure it out, seeing it's her neurologist's office is doing the study.
Mm-hmm.
But so even...
You don't have respite at all there that you can tap into for someone
to... Yeah, but it all costs money. It all costs money.
Okay.
And
there's, you don't have any group or friends that would be willing to stay with Kay while you do that, I see. Okay.
No.
Kay,
friends, mm-hmm. Alzheimer's comes and friends disappear.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That happens a lot. not with people. I'm going to go ahead and pull Kay back into the conversation here. So, Kay, as far as a group, do you do a lot on social media as far as connecting with people?
We have several active GLBT groups that are in Charleston, and two of them have offered to advertise the program that I'm trying to pull together and see what happens, you know, see how many people come. After I threw in my preliminary work, that's the way I'll be doing it, is through advertising on their monthly newsletters and magazines. And hopefully we'll have a good response. Down here in Charleston, the GLBT community is right out there. I mean, they're not hidden or anything like that. They hold parades, they hold dinners, movies, and so on and so forth. And any legislation that comes up and things like that, they're right there demonstrating it. So, that's encouraging. That there are folks there that are willing to step out and be a part and say, hey, I'm a human being. I'm just like you, and I have the same desires and hopes and dreams as you do. And there's really nothing different between us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the stigma that's there, that people think that, you're treated as a leper in some cases, unclean, particularly in the Bible Belt where, a lot are accepted.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and pull Sam back into the conversation here because we want to wrap up our hour here. Sam, do you have some comments that you want to add about support groups? And
I would, yes. I think it's important to know that, as we as an association are working on a lot of things to really reach individuals in any capacity that we can to better serve them. We do have a lot of good support groups, and these support groups nationwide are set up to be there to meet the needs of individuals and families that are facing Alzheimer's and dementia. Alzheimer's and dementia doesn't really care who you are or where they come from. And so these support groups are safe and confidential, and so we want to make sure people are connected and get connected if they need that. And then we will be coming up with a lot of good things coming forward real soon through the National Association, and there are a lot of good work that's being done in the chapters now. So I would like to let listeners know that please contact your local chapters to see what kind of work is being done in those particular chapters, and they can do that through the 800 number that we have, Helpline. Yes, ma'am.
I was just going to say that the 800 number is 800-272-3900, 800-272-3900.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And we have a lot of other set up resources online as well. The contact number that you had just given out for anyone that has a question about anything day or night, they can call that number and speak with our professionals, Care Confidential, for any questions that they may have. I think the message I'd like for anybody to know is that if you have some concerns or a family member concerns, talk to someone, talk to anybody you need to make sure that you get the particular answers that you're looking for, or at least the help that you may need. We with Association here, you, Lori, are doing a great job, and we're just very appreciative of what we're being allowed to come on today. I thank Kay and everyone else and Lisa for being to come up and have the courage to come out and speak on what they're speaking of. But people need to just know that it's okay. come out and let's talk about it so we can get that help and care that people need so we can move forward so they can order to prepare for their lives as they go forward.
Yep, have the conversations. I think it's very, very important for people to be able to do that. We have on the page all different contacts for the Alzheimer's Association. So the main website, the www.alz.org, there's a caregiver center that is noted there, as well as the Alzheimer's Navigator. And do you want to tell people what they can find in the caregiver center and the Navigator?
I can. The Caregiver Center is specifically designed, it's taken all of the pieces on our website of the good information that we have, and it's actually put together in the Caregiver Center. So it helps individuals when they're looking for certain information. They don't have to try to go point A, point B, point C. They can go into the Caregiver Center, and we have it condensed down where it's all the information they could possibly be looking for would be in the Caregiver Center, anywhere from driving to behaviors to progression of the disease, safety resources and support groups, everything that someone may need to look for. We put it into the Caregiver Center so they don't have to go looking for it. With the Navigator, it is basically an online assessment tool. So it's really designed for anybody who wants to, instead of possibly even making that phone call to the association, if they want to go on there themselves and type in information into this Navigator, it is an assessment tool that the more information you put in, the more information you get out. And it's kind of one of those, it's almost a help call, but it's through the actual Internet. So it's very good information. In that sense, I also just like to make mention of the All's Connected. I failed to send that to you, Lori, but the All's Connected, it's www.alzconnected.org. It is an online message board that anyone can actually go to and speak to and find private and public groups that are speaking about Alzheimer's and dementia, and it's a very good piece of tool that we have as well. I wanted to put that out there.
Okay, great. And there also is a brochure that people can download for the LGBT caregiver concerns that I would recommend. Again, that link is on the front page here of the radio show. So go ahead and go to that link where you can download that as well and find some help. And again, let your voice be heard. We can't get you help if we don't know what it is that you're really looking for. And so that's just a critical piece to be able to find out about that. So I thank you so much, Sam, for being with us. And I'm sure we'll connect in the future here. And Kay, did you
Yes.
have any last comments that you wanted to make to the audience?
If anybody is interested in talking with me, I have an email, which is kfox, spelled out K-A-Y-E-F-O-X, at sc.rr.com. And I'll be happy to correspond with anyone that has any questions or concerns or needs help in any way.
Okay, wonderful. Lisa, any comments that you have?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Well, thank you all for being with us today. I really appreciate your time and your full disclosure and honesty. I think that's just so important to be able to have these honest conversations with people is just absolutely critical. So thank you again for being with us. I do want to remind people that we have a Dementia Chats webinar coming up. And that will be on the 9th at 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, and that would be noon Pacific time. Those are free, and you'll be able to see those posted on the website and the blog. As far as future shows that we have coming up, on the 11th, we're going to be talking about Dare to Care, and we'll have the author of that book with us, along with a researcher by the name of Dr. Donald Moss, who has some pretty interesting stuff he's doing. I think you'll want to listen in on that. And then on the 18th, we will be talking to ADI, the Alzheimer's Disease International group, at their conference over in Asia, And we're also going to learn about a new app called Balance that the Hebrew Home has put out. On the 24th, we are going to have the Awakenings program with Ecumen with us. And rolling into May, I can't believe that'll be here before we know it, Tom and Karen Brenner, who are the authors of You Say Goodbye, We Say Hello, and Ellen Gerst on grieving will be part of the show as well. I did post in the chat box something that I'm pretty excited about. Here in St. Paul, they had a contest for, it's called St. Paul Forever Challenge, and it was looking for a $1 million idea. So I submitted dementia-friendly businesses and communities. And yesterday was the closeout of the registration, and so they had a big write-up in the St. Paul Pioneer Press with that, and they had, I think, over 900 entries. And of that, they highlighted, I don't know, 25 or 30 of which our dementia-friendly one was mentioned, which is great. So I put the links in the chat box, and if people would take time just to copy those down, go read the proposal and make a comment in terms of support of getting our community to be dementia-friendly, because even if you don't live in Minnesota or in St. Paul, you know, something like this is going to have an impact all around the world in terms of getting attention for the needs that are out there. So we would love to hear from you on that. In closing, I just want to say, again, thank you all for being so supportive. I absolutely love doing these shows and love talking to people and connecting people. And we just, you know, are drawn to have this conversation together to make the world dementia-friendly, to make it acceptable so that people don't have to lose their friends and don't have to go through this isolation, and teach people how to live with the disease. So have a wonderful weekend. Keep in mind your memory chip and what that teaches you to focus on. Are they safe? Are they happy? And are they pain-free? And you can go to www.alzheimerspeaks.com and go to tools and pick up your free memory chip, or just scope us out and see all the other wonderful information that we have posted there. Have a blessed day. Bye now.